This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. As more and more details emerge about Robert Kraft's alleged solicitation of prostitution, it's easy to see the case as tabloid fodder. But police say it's actually a window into the dark world of human trafficking, a world that is much bigger than any single person. And you don't have to go to Florida to see it. In fact, you don't even have to leave Massachusetts. WBUR's Shannon Dooling begins our show with this look at the scope of trafficking right here in Greater Boston.
A Beverly couple arrested for trafficking women for sex at a Salem brothel. A Lynn woman indicted for trafficking a minor from a Saugus group home. Two indicted for trafficking women for sex at Springfield massage parlors. Those are a few of the headlines coming out of State Attorney General Maura Healey's office over the last year. Since Governor Deval Patrick signed the state's anti-trafficking law in 2011, more than 40 individuals have been charged in connection with trafficking crimes. My Life, My Choice is a Boston-based nonprofit that supports victims and survivors of sex trafficking. The group's Audrey Morrissey says a common public perception is that trafficking is more rampant among non-citizens. But she says young women and children born in the U.S. can be victims of trafficking, too. She says the two populations share distinct vulnerabilities.
Number one, poverty. When someone does not have resources that a lot of us take for granted, and someone promises a new way to live, right? A lot of disruption in the family could be what makes them vulnerable. They have no family.
Poverty, family upheaval, these are universal stressors that people who operate in human trafficking, both abroad and in Massachusetts, use to prey on their victims. Another tool? Fear, especially for those who have been trafficked from other countries.
I would definitely say that victims of human trafficking are the most frightened, the most vulnerable, the most underground of most of the crime victims that we work with.
Susan Church is a Boston-based immigration attorney. She says one of the most common fears among non-citizen victims is being deported. There are options for victims who are willing and able to come forward, Church says. The humanitarian T visa allows a victim of trafficking who cooperates with authorities to stay in the U.S. for several months and potentially apply for residency. The federal government issues a maximum of 5,000 T visas a year, a cap that's hardly ever reached. But after stories like that of Robert Kraft's alleged sex solicitation in Florida, Church says that might change.
I expect that in cases where high-profile trafficking cases hit the news, you will start to see lawyers screaming better for T visa eligibility, and then you will see the cap reached.
At Boston University's Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Program, Director Julie Dahlstrom says the clinic sees a range of clients and cases. Some include victims trafficked into massage parlors, like the one investigated in Kraft's case.
And I would say we see a variety of different kind of ethnicities, and this is not something that only impacts U.S. citizens or individuals who are, you know, from a particular community. Unfortunately, it is across the board.
We continue to have an increase in referrals.
That's Lisa Goldblack-Race. She's executive director of My Life, My Choice. And she's talking about an increase in referrals of young people who may be caught up in sexual exploitation.
Part of that is really the result of more and more folks are getting educated and are realizing that young person in front of them isn't a delinquent, but actually is a victim in need of support.
Goldblack-Race says on average, the young people referred to them for services are between 13 and 15 years old. She's hopeful that offering them support at a young age can help ease the transition out of sex work.
That report from WBUR's Shannon Dooling. And in Shannon's report, we heard from Boston University law professor Julie Dahlstrom. Again, she's the director of BU Law's Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Program. We wanted to continue the conversation about the magnitude of the problem. The Florida investigation that ensnared Kraft involved multiple law enforcement agencies and spanned several months. So I began by asking Dahlstrom whether the kind of scale is typical in sex trafficking cases.
It's fairly common that investigations will involve multiple agencies and often multiple states. One thing that's interesting and a common misconception is that trafficking doesn't have to involve movement, but it's true that it does often span, you know, federal and state law enforcement because it can involve both state and federal crimes.
And we noted that the lead investigator in the Jupiter case in particular said he had been referred to the specific spa in Jupiter where they allegedly found Robert Kraft by an investigation happening in another jurisdiction. So this seemed to be a case where the probe just continued to get wider and wider the deeper they dug. Is that also typical?
You know, I think that it's very common. What we see nationally is that sex trafficking cases are often more investigated affirmatively in the sense of, you know, much of the information is available online because there are commercial sex ads, and in fact also buyer review boards where buyers might even post about their experiences. So there's a plethora of information available online and many of these cases. So in fact, investigators can move affirmatively and try to engage in these investigations, which are both time-intensive and also very complex.
Julie, what's the scope of the issue that we're talking about here? I mean, this seemed large on its face, and yet we're only talking about Florida. My understanding, as we've seen more and more reporting on this in recent days, is that this is a nationwide problem in all 50 states. Just how big is it?
You are indeed correct. This is unfortunately a problem in every state. You know, I think we've also had very recent comments from the president drawing attention to trafficking at the border. But in fact, this is a phenomenon that often does not involve the border, that involves U.S. citizens and non-citizens and occurs in all jurisdictions. The good news is we now have 50 states that have passed trafficking legislation. And so in many ways, there are the tools to combat the crime. But because of its underground nature, it still remains challenging to investigate and prosecute. And from my perspective, we represent survivors of trafficking. It also is increasingly challenging for survivors to receive much-needed benefits like immigration protection or other types of benefits like victim compensation.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the border, because the way the president has described the issue is perhaps one side of it. You know, he paints this picture of trucks trying to sneak across the border with women packed inside and their mouths duct taped. And that may be one aspect of it. But as we've learned more about this, we also understand that sometimes the women come to the U.S. Not in such sneaky terms, but perhaps they're lured here on the promise of a better life. Can you give us some insight into how that can work?
Yes, I think what's problematic about the president's rhetoric around trafficking are a number of things. First, you know, there's very much a conflation of what is trafficking and smuggling. Smuggling generally being a crime against the border that may involve, you know, moving individuals who are undocumented across a border. Trafficking really focusing on exploitation. And while those two things do sometimes occur together, they're often very disconnected. And in fact, you know, what we've represented non-citizens who are in the U.S. And undocumented, and because of certain vulnerabilities, may fall prey to perpetrators of trafficking. So it doesn't mean that you have to have been brought here for that purpose. And in fact, as I mentioned, many U.S. citizens also are survivors.
So on that note, in your research, do you find certain groups of people who are disproportionately affected? We know some immigrants. In fact, we've seen that. That appears to be the case here in Florida, but perhaps among the U.S. population, who is most likely to fall prey?
So I do think it's important not to overgeneralize, but there is research that has really looked at especially U.S. citizens and the connection between aging out of residential and foster care programs as creating vulnerability and a disparate impact on those who are in that age range of kind of 18 to 24. There's also connections between sort of victimization, poverty, and past histories of sexual abuse. Immigration status for non-citizens, I think, is both a particular vulnerability and has been more so given the current immigration climate, increased immigration enforcement efforts, and the fact that perpetrators now know they don't have to use physical violence to force or coerce someone to work. In fact, the threat of deportation alone in this climate is enough.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that stood out to me in our reporting here at WBUR was that there is a specific visa program available in some cases to women who are willing to cooperate in trafficking investigations, and the national cap is only 5,000, and it seldom is reached, which suggests that in a lot of cases, these women are afraid to come forward and afraid to cooperate with authorities. Can you give us a sense of what resources are available to them, which perhaps in some cases aren't even being exercised because of the fear factor?
That's absolutely correct. So the good news is that there are special immigration benefits for survivors of trafficking, namely this T visa, and there are 5,000 available every year. And with that comes the right to remain, in some cases petition for family members and eventually have a pathway to residency here in the United States. There have been tremendous challenges in accessing those protections, one of which is that a requirement is to cooperate with law enforcement, although there are some limited exceptions. And as you can imagine, it can be very challenging for survivors to report to law enforcement when they may be fearful of reprisals from the perpetrators, or in this current climate, distrust law enforcement or think they may be connected to immigration. Now, while that's not always the case, definitely the increased collaboration among law enforcement agencies has given rise to greater and greater fears. But I think the good news is that these benefits are still available. There are some current policies under this administration around referring denied cases to immigration court or removal proceedings, which are new and very disturbing. But we definitely still are representing clients who are having success in that process.
Well, Julie, is one of the trust issues with law enforcement there, too, that in a lot of cases, historically, we've treated prostitution as a crime and the women involved as criminals instead of victims. And do you see that changing at all?
I do see that changing. I think the good news is that in the greater Boston area and beyond, what we're seeing is that law enforcement increasingly are not arresting individuals for sex for fee or related charges. Also, in the last criminal justice reform bill that was passed this summer, there were provisions around vacating criminal offenses, for example, sex for fee for survivors of trafficking, which dovetails with national efforts to do this as well. So I do think that there is a growing movement in that direction, but there still needs to be further reform.
Julie, I'm mindful that this is a longstanding, ongoing problem, and yet we're talking about it this week specifically because a high-profile figure was ensnared in the investigation. How would you like to see this conversation unfold? Are we doing this the right way in the press, in law enforcement, in society, when we talk about Robert Kraft in particular?
I think it is important and good news that there is greater attention to this issue. I hope that it will be prolonged, and I also hope that it leads to more nuanced discussions of this crime, rather than sort of simplistic narratives that don't help us create viable alternatives for both survivors and the general public.
That's Julie Dahlstrom, Boston University law professor and director of BU Law's Immigrants' Rights and Human Trafficking Program. Julie, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
All right, we just heard a bit from Julie Dahlstrom about the role that law enforcement plays in combating human trafficking. For more on that, we turn to Carmen Ortiz, the former U.S. attorney from Massachusetts. She's now in private practice at Anderson & Krieger in Boston. Hi there, Carmen.
Hi, Callum. How are you?
I'm pretty well. I know that your office dealt with some trafficking cases during your time as U.S. attorney, so I'm hoping you can tell us a bit about what goes into this kind of work. I mean, how does law enforcement identify a ring, gather evidence, and then ultimately take it down?
Well, in many of these cases, either an agency will make a report of a girl that has come to them, an agency sort of, or an organization like My Life, My Choice. Someone will end up at a hospital. It'll be someone who's arrested in a particular area. Complaints will be made about a particular location if they're trafficking women or having some kind of sexual activity in that location. And so the complaint will come in, and then there'll be an investigation that'll be conducted. If they think that there's a particular business, for example, that's being utilized as a massage or some kind of other, the type of business where women are being sold for sex, then they can do an undercover operation. They can send someone in who can have a conversation with whoever is working at the place. And if there's a discussion about exchanging sex for money and being able to purchase it, that might suffice. But if you think it's a big operation, you can do an outside surveillance so that you see people coming in and out. And what you want is probable cause to be able to put in cameras and get a court order so that you can do basically what was done in the Florida massage parlor and the case, more recent case that has been highlighted in the media. You can show exactly that not only are they having conversations about paying money in exchange for sex, but then you can highlight the sexual activity. And that's really important where you're focusing and targeting the individuals who are the Johns, the purchasers of those services. Because if you're just focusing on who's running the business, if law enforcement goes in an undercover capacity and has a conversation where they're willing to take money and you exchange hands, money in exchange for sex, that might be sufficient. But typically for a trafficking case, you want to be able to show and have the cooperation of victims that are engaged in that kind of activity and use them to prosecute the perpetrators, which are really the targets at a federal level, more the people who are making the money and exploiting young women in this arena.
Well, so how hard, though, is it to get the cooperation of those women who are being trafficked, Carmen? Because I can imagine a lot of barriers. Some of them may not speak English. They may be afraid of the people who are controlling them. They may be afraid of deportation. I mean, can you speak to that challenge?
Absolutely. There's two areas here. You have the you know, women who come from foreign countries, and you're right, they don't speak the language, but you need to be able to try to break through to one. It could be one that's ended up in a hospital because she's been beaten up. It could be one that's been arrested. And the challenges are is to try to overcome, and you work with victim witness advocates, social workers, law enforcement. You work with them to try to overcome the fear that they feel, because they have been, on many occasions, obviously, they've been exploited because they've been beaten. They've been exposed to violence. There's the sense of loyalty to the perpetrator. Some of these perpetrators provide with these young trafficking victims with the sense that that they love them, that they care for them, that they will take care of them. And so there's a degree of dependability. And so what law enforcement has to do is crack through those barriers, that fear and dependability, loyalty, and lack of trust of the government is also another arena that is a challenge for the government. And I think what happens is that you have to work with others in social services to help these victims overcome their fear and really try to provide them with support, a sense of safety, by putting them in a safe house, by providing them with fundings, and many of these you can, with women from particular who are illegal immigrants or who are fearing deportation. There are different mechanisms in the immigration laws. If they become a cooperating witness, there are different, there's a certain visa, I can't recall right now the type of visa, but there are ways that they can remain in this country as long as they testify and cooperate with the government. But law enforcement has to really work with a social agency and an organization to help these women be able to overcome their fears.
You know, Carmen, one of the things that stands out in the Florida investigation is that one of the alleged ringleaders is a woman named Lan Yun Ma, who was arrested in a similar case here in Oxford, Massachusetts, 7 years ago. It was a similar situation, smaller scale, but you had a massage parlor that was accused of trafficking and holding women in sexual servitude. Ma was initially charged with human trafficking in state court here, but she ultimately pleaded down to solicitation for prostitution, got a 30-day sentence, 3 years of probation. And now she's allegedly been able to pick up and move her operation to Florida. So how does that happen, Carmen? I mean, is that someone just sort of slipping through the judicial system? What goes wrong there where someone is allowed to allegedly reoffend?
Well, it's not that they're allowed to reoffend. It's that, you know, some of these penalties, depending upon how they're charged, for example, do not carry high penalties. Like you said, she was given 30 days. She paid a fine. She may have been on probation for a certain period of time, but then that probation ends and they're free really to move around this country or elsewhere. So it's obvious that she's relocated to Florida and now engaging again in this business. It's very profitable. There are women that, though, are co-conspirators. For example, on the federal level, some of these are the individuals that are convicted don't really engage in this activity. Again, by the time the feds get in, there were a number of cases we did in which some of the traffickers received 20, 25 year, 30 year sentences. And these were individuals who, you know, were convicted of trafficking minors and engaging in tremendous violence in attempts to kill other witnesses. And so the more egregious the conduct, the lengthier the sentence, and then they cannot reoffend. But someone like this who, especially for solicitation for prostitution, these are not serious sentences. And the folks that are prosecuted that have engaged in it, that have actually paid the money, many times there's no prison time or jail time. You just pay a fine and the case is dismissed.
It is a really wide range, though. I mean, 30 years or 30 days. I mean, do prosecutors have the tools they need, Carmen, or do they sometimes feel like, you know, even if I bring down one of these rings, that people can kind of get away or get off relatively easy and then can continue to do their business somewhere else?
You know, it really depends on how big the ring is, how significant, what the evidence is. Have they really engaged in violent criminal activity? The more serious and egregious that the behavior is, the more serious the charges and obviously the lengthier the sentence. If you get prosecuted on the state level, the sentences aren't so high, although I know that the sex trafficking, human trafficking statutes were amended a number of years ago here in Massachusetts, and I think there are stiffer penalties. But there's no question that the penalties at the federal level are more serious.
Well, you mentioning that toughening of the human trafficking law here in Massachusetts, and I'll just point out that Lan Yuan Ma was arrested and charged in Massachusetts before that law change went into effect. Carmen Ortiz, attorney for Anderson & Krieger and the former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll preview the Trump-Kim summit in Vietnam. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.